tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Alright folks, we are back with The International Jew by Henry Ford. This is Caucasian Christian Communications. Alright, the next article is entitled Jewish Testimony in Favor of Bolshevism. And we start out with an excerpt from an article in the American Hebrew, which was published September 10th, 1920, which, according to my recollection here, should be pretty close to the time they printed this article. Here is the excerpt. Out of the economic chaos, the discontent of the Jew evolved organized capital with its working instrumentality, the banking system. One of the most impressive phenomena of the impressive time is the revolt of the Jew against the Frankenstein, which his own mind conceived and his own hand fashioned. That achievement, being the Russian Bolshevik Revolution, destined to figure in history as the overshadowing result of the First World War, was largely the outcome of Jewish thinking, of Jewish discontent, of Jewish effort to reconstruct. What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia, the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind and heart are tending to promote in other countries. Shall America, like the Russia of the Tsars, overwhelm the Jew with the bitter and baseless reproach of being a destroyer, and thus put him in the position of an irreconcilable enemy? Or shall America avail itself of Jewish genius as it avails itself of the peculiar genius of every other race? That is the question for the American people to answer. That's the end of that excerpt. Again, that's from an article in the American Hebrew published September 10th, 1920. Okay, Jewish testimony in favor of Bolshevism. The American people will answer that question, and their answer will be against the disruptive genius of dissatisfied Jews. It is very well known that what Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia is also being attempted in the United States. Why did not the writer in the American Hebrew say the United States instead of saying the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind and heart are tending to promote in other countries? Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent, as quoted above, are not directed against capital. Capital is enlisted in their service. The only governmental order the Jewish effort is directed against is Gentile governmental order, and the only capital it attacks is Gentile capital. Lord Eustace Percy, who, if one may judge by the full and appreciative quotations of his words in the Jewish press, has the sanction of thinkers among the Jews, settles the first point. Discussing the Jewish tendency to revolutionary movements, he says, "In Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism often seem to grow side by side, just as Jewish influence molded Republican and Socialist thought throughout the 19th century, down to the Young Turk Revolution in Constantinople hardly more than a decade ago. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is ever anything but distasteful to him." And that analysis is absolutely true. In Russia, the excuse was the Tsar. In Germany, the Kaiser. In England, it is the Irish question. In the numerous South American revolutions, where the Jews always had a ruling hand, no particular reason was thought necessary to be given. In the United States, it is the capitalistic class, quote-unquote. But always and everywhere it is, by the confession of their own spokesman, a distaste for any form whatsoever of Gentile government. The Jew believes that the world is his by right. He wants to collect his own, and the speediest way of doing so is the destruction of order by revolution, a destruction which is made possible by a long and clever campaign of loose and destructive ideas. As to the second point, every reader can verify the fact from his own experience. Let him recall to mind the capitalists who have been held up to public scorn in the Jew-controlled press of the United States. And whom does he find them to be? Whose forms have you seen caricatured with the dollar mark in Hearst's papers? Are they Seligman, Kahn, Warburg, Schiff, Kuhn Loeb and Company, or any of the others? No. These are Jewish bankers. The attack is never made on them. The names made most familiar to you by newspaper denunciation are the names of Gentile industrial and banking leaders, and Gentile leaders only, the principal ones being J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller. It is a well-known fact that during the French Commune, when men of wealth suffered severe losses in property, the Jewish Rothschilds were not injured to the extent of one pennyworth. It is also a well-known fact, capable of proof satisfactory to any ordinary mind, that the connections between Jewish financiers and the more dangerous revolutionary elements here in the United States are such that it is most unlikely that the former stand to lose anything in any event. Under cover of the disorder in Russia at the present time, Jewish financiers are taking advantage of the stress of the people to gain control of all the strategic natural resources and municipal property, by methods which they fully expect to be legalized by Jewish courts when the present Bolshevik regime announces that it will give way to a modified communism. The world hasn't seen the end of Bolshevism yet. Like the World War, Bolshevism cannot be interpreted until it is seen who profits most by it, and the profiteering is in full sway now. The enemy is Gentile capital, not any other, and all the wealth of the world is in our hands, that quote which was mentioned above, is the unspoken slogan of every Jewish outbreak in the world today. The quotation at the head, of this article, represents the position which the Jews are now ready to take with reference to the Russian Revolution. They have always been charged with responsibility for what has occurred in that unhappy country, but at first their spokesmen denied it. The denials were most indignant and were usually accompanied by the typical plaint that the charge was poisecution. But the facts have been so overwhelming and the government investigations have been so revealing that denials have been abandoned. For a while, an attempt was made to distract attention from Russia by a tremendously powerful propaganda concerning the Jews in Poland. There are many indications that the Polish propaganda was undertaken as a cover for the immense immigration of Jews into the United States. It may be that some of our readers do not know it, but an endless stream of the most undesirable immigrants pours daily into the United States. Tens of thousands of the same people whose presence has been the problem and menace of the governments of Europe. Well, the Polish propaganda and the immigration movement are sailing along smoothly, and the United States government is assured by the Jewish ring at Washington that everything is quiet along the Potomac. It is quiet there, quiet as the Jewish ring could wish. But still, the Russian fact persists in calling for explanation. And here's the explanation. The Jews created capitalism, we're told. But capitalism has proved itself ill-behaved. So now, the Jewish creators are going to destroy their creation. They have done so in Russia. And now, will the American people be good and let their Jewish benefactors do the same in America? That is the new explanation. And, typically Jewish again, it is coupled with a proposal for the United States. And a threat. If America refuses this particular service of the Jew, we put him in a position of an irreconcilable enemy, as was quoted in the original excerpt at the beginning of this article, from the American Hebrew article. But the Jews have not destroyed capitalism in Russia. When Lenin and Trotsky made their farewell vow and retire under the protective influence of the Jewish capitalists of the world, it will be seen that only Gentile or Russian capital has been destroyed, and that Jewish capital has been enthroned. What is the record? Documents printed by the United States government contain this letter. Please note the date, the Jewish banker, and the Jewish name. Here we go. Top of the letter. Stockholm, September 21st, 1917. To Mr. Raphael Scholin. Dear comrade, the banking house, M. Warburg, opened an account for the enterprise of Comrade Trotsky upon receipt of a telegram from the chairman of the Rhine-Westphalian Syndicate. A lawyer, probably Mr. Kestroff, obtained ammunition and organized the transportation of same, together with that of the money to whom the sum demanded by Comrade Trotsky is to be handed. Fraternal greetings, Furstenberg. Long before that, an American Jewish financier was supplying the funds which carried revolutionary propaganda to thousands of Russian pioneers of war. I'm sorry. Let me read that one again for you, Sven. Long before that, an American Jewish financier was supplying the funds which carried revolutionary propaganda to thousands of Russian prisoners of war in Japanese camps. It is sometimes said, by way of explaining the Bolshevik movement, that it was financed from Germany, a fact which was seized upon to supply war propaganda. It is true that part of the money came from Germany. It is true that part of the money came from the United States. It is the whole truth that Jewish finance in all the countries was interested in Bolshevism as an all-Jewish investment. For the whole period of the war, the Jewish world program was cloaked under this or that national name, the blame being laid on the Germans by the Allies, and on the Allies by the Germans, and the people kept in ignorance of who the real personages were. It was stated by a French official that two millions of money was contributed by one Jewish banker alone. When Trotsky left the United States to fulfill his appointed task, he was released from arrest at Halifax upon request of the United States, and everyone knows who constituted the war government of the United States. The conclusion, when all facts are considered, is irresistible, that the Bolshevik Revolution was a carefully groomed investment on the part of international Jewish finance. It's easy to understand, then, why the same forces would like to introduce it to the United States. The real struggle in this country is not between labor and capital. The real struggle is between Jewish capital and Gentile capital, with the international workers of the world leaders, the socialist leaders, the red leaders, and the labor leaders almost a unit on the side of the Jewish capitalists. Again, recall which financiers these men most attack. You cannot recall a single Jewish name. The main purpose in these two articles, however, is to introduce the Jewish testimony which exists as to the Jewish nature of Bolshevism. The Jewish Chronicle of London said this in 1919. There is much in the fact of Bolshevism itself, in the fact that so many Jews are Bolsheviks, in the fact that the ideals of Bolshevism at many points are consonant with the finest ideals of Judaism. In the same paper of 1920, there's a report of an address made by Israel Zangwill, a noted Jewish writer, in which he pronounced glowing praise on the race which has produced a Beaconsfield, a Reading, a Montag, a Klotz, a Kurt Eisner, a Trotsky. Mr. Zangwill, in his swelling Semitic enthusiasm, embraced the Jews in the British government in the very same category with the Jews of the Hungarian and Russian Bolshevik governments. What's the difference? They are all Jewish, in all of the equal honor and usefulness to the race. Rabbi J.L. Magnus, in an address at New York in 1919, is reported to have said this: "When the Jew gives his thought, his devotion, to the cause of the workers and of the dispossessed, of the disinherited of the world, the radical quality within him goes to the roots of things, and in Germany he becomes a Marx and a LaSalle, a Haas and an Edward Bernstein. In Austria he becomes a Victor Adler and a Friedrich Adler. In Russia he becomes a Trotsky. Just take for a moment the present situation in Russia and in Germany. The revolution set creative forces free, and see what a large company of Jews was available for immediate service. Socialist revolutionaries and Mensheviki and Bolsheviki, majority and minority socialists, whatever they be called, Jews are to be found among the trusted leaders and the routine workers of all these revolutionary parties. See," says the rabbi, "what a large company of Jews are available for immediate service." One ought to see where he points. There are as many Jewish members of revolutionary societies in the United States as there were in Russia. And here, as there, they are, quote-unquote, available for immediate service. Bernard Lazar, a Jewish writer who has published a work on anti-Semitism, says, "The Jew, therefore, does take part in revolutions, and he participates in them so far as he is a Jew, or, more correctly, in so far as he remains a Jew." He says also, "The Jewish spirit is essentially a revolutionary spirit, and consciously or otherwise, the Jew is a revolutionist." There's hardly any country in the world, except the U.S., where denials of this could be made in such a way as to require proof. In every other country, the fact is known. Here, we have been under such a fear of mentioning the word Jew, or anything pertaining to it, that the commonest facts have been kept from us, facts which even a superficial knowledge of Jewish writing would have given us. It was almost a pathetic spectacle to see American audiences go to lectures about the Russian situation and come away from the hall confused and perplexed because the Russian situation is so un-Russian, all because no lecturer thought it politic to mention Jew in the U.S., for, as someday we shall see, the Jew has contrived to gain control of the platform, too. Not only do the literary lights of Jewry acknowledge the Jew's propensity to revolution generally, and his responsibility for the Russian situation particularly, but the lower lights also have a very clear idea about it. The Jew, in the midst of the revolution, is conscious that somehow he is advancing the cause of Israel. He may be a bad Jew in the synagogue sense, but he is enough of a Jew to be willing to do anything that would advance the prestige of Israel. Race is stronger than religion in Jewry. Boy, that's worth repeating. Race is stronger than religion in Jewry. The Russian paper, On to Moscow, in September 1919, said this: "It should not be forgotten that the Jewish people, who for centuries were oppressed by kings and czars, are the real proletariat, the real international, which has no country." Mr. Cohen, in the newspaper Communist, in April 1919, said this: "Without exaggeration, it may be said that the great Russian social revolution was indeed accomplished by the hands of the Jews. Would the dark, oppressed masses of the Russian workmen and peasants have been able to throw off the yoke of the bourgeoisie by themselves? No, it was precisely the Jews who led the Russian proletariat to the dawn of the International, and not only have led, but are also now leading the Soviet cause, which remains in their safe hands. We may be quiet as long as the chief command of the Red Army is in the hands of Comrade Leon Trotsky. It is true that there are no Jews in the ranks of the Red Army as far as privates are concerned, but in the committees and Soviet organizations, as commissars, the Jews are gallantly leading the masses of the Russian proletariat to victory. It is not without reason that during the elections to all Soviet institutions, the Jews are winning by an overwhelming majority. The symbol of Jewry, which for centuries has struggled against capitalism, has become also the symbol of the Russian proletariat, which can be seen even in the adoption of the red five-pointed star, which, in former times, as it is well known, was the symbol of Zionism and Jewry. With this sign comes victory. With this sign comes the death of the parasites of the bourgeoisie. Jewish tears will come out of them in sweat of drops of blood. That's the end of the excerpt from Mr. Cohen in the Communist newspaper in April 1919. This confession, or rather this boast, is remarkable for its completeness. The Jews, says Mr. Cohen, are in control of the Russian masses who have never risen at all, who only know that a minority, like the Tsar's minority, is in control at the seat of the government. The Jews are not in the Red Army, Mr. Cohen informs us, that is, in the ranks where the actual fighting is done, and this is strictly in line with the protocols. The strategy of the world program is to set Gentiles to kill Gentiles. This was the Jewish boast during the various French social disasters that so many Frenchmen had been set killing each other. In the World War just past, there were as many Gentiles killed by Gentiles as there are Jews in the world. It was a great victory for Israel. Jewish tears will come out of them in sweat of drops of blood. But the Jews are in the places of control and safety, says Mr. Cohen, and he is absolutely right about it. The wonder is that he was so honest as to say it. As to the elections, so-called, at which the Jews are so unanimously chosen, the literature of Bolshevism is very explicit. Those who voted against the Jewish candidates were adjudged as enemies of the revolution and executed. It did not require many executions at a voting place to make all the elections unanimous. Mr. Cohen is especially instructive on the significance of the Red Star, the five-pointed emblem of Bolshevism. The symbol of Jewry, he says, has become also the symbol of the Russian proletariat. The Star of David, the Jewish national emblem, is a six-pointed star, formed by two triangles, one standing on its base and the other on its apex. Deprived of their baselines, these triangles approximate the familiar Masonic emblem of the square and the compass. It is this Star of David, of which a Jewish observer in Palestine remarks that there are so few among the graves of the British soldiers who won Palestine in the recent war. Most of the signs are the familiar wooden cross. These crosses are now reported to be objectionable to the new rulers of Palestine because they are so plainly in view of the visitor who approaches the new Jewish university. As in Soviet Russia, so in Palestine, not many Jews laid down their lives for the cause. There were plenty of Gentiles for that purpose. As the Jew is a past master in the art of symbolism, it may not be without significance that the Bolshevik star has one point less than the Star of David. For there is still one point to be fulfilled in the world program as outlined in the protocols, and that is the enthronement of our leader, quote-unquote. When he comes, the world autocrat for whom the whole program is framed, the sixth point may be added. The 5 points of the star now apparently assured are the purse, the press, the peerage, Palestine, and proletarianism. The sixth point will be the Prince of Israel. It is very hard to say, it is hard to believe, but Mr. Cohen has said it, in revolutions, especially since the French Revolution confirm it, that, with this sign comes the death of the parasites of the bourgeoisie. Jewish tears will come out of them in sweat of drops of blood. The bourgeoisie, as the protocols say, are always the Gentiles. The common counter-argument to the invincible fact of the Jewish character of the Russian Revolution, an argument which is destined to disappear now that Jewish acknowledgement is coming thick and fast, is that the Jews in Russia suffer too. How can we favor a movement which makes our own people suffer? Is the argument put up to the Gentiles. Well, the fact is, they are favoring that movement. Today, this very moment, the Bolshevik government is receiving money from Jewish financiers in Europe, and if in Europe, then of course from the international Jewish bankers in America also. That is one fact. Another fact is this. The Jews of Russia are not suffering to anywhere near the extent we are told by the propagandists. It is now a fact admitted by Jews themselves that upon the very first sweep of the Bolshevists across Poland, the Polish Jews were friendly with the invaders and helped them. The fact was explained by American Jews in this manner. Since Bolshevism came to Russia, the condition of the Jews there has greatly improved. Therefore, the Polish Jews were friendly. And it is true. The condition of Russian Jews is good. One reason is, they have Russia. Everything there belongs to them. The other reason is, the Jews of Russia are the only ones receiving help there today. Did that second statement ever strike you as significant? Only the Jews of Russia have food and money sent to them. It is one form, of course, of the support which the Jewish world is giving Bolshevism. But if the suffering among the Jews is what the propagandists say it is, what must it be among the Russians? Yet no one's sending food or money to them, the Russian Gentiles. The probable truth of the whole situation is that Jewish Bolshevism is laying a tax on the world. Any time it may be required, there is plenty of evidence as to the good condition of the Jews in Russia. They have all there is. Another source of confusion is revealed in this question. How can Jewish capitalists support Bolshevism when Bolshevism is against capitalism? Bolshevism, as stated before stated, I'm sorry, Sven, I'm going to start that last line over. Bolshevism, as stated before, is only against Gentile capitalism. Jewish financiers who remained in Russia are very useful to the Bolsheviki. Read this description by an eyewitness. A Jew is this commissary of the bank, very elegant, with a cravat of the latest style, and a fancy waistcoat. A Jew is this district commissary, former stockbroker, with a double bourgeois chin. Again a Jew, this inspector of taxes. He understands perfectly how to squeeze the bourgeoisie. These agents of Jewry are still there. Other agents are among the Russians who fled, getting their lands away from them on mortgage loans. When the curtain lifts, most of the choice real estate will be found to have passed into Jewish control by perfectly, quote-unquote, legal means. That is one answer to the question, why the Jewish capitalists support Bolshevism. The Red Revolution is the greatest speculative event of human history. Besides, it is for the exaltation of Israel. It is a colossal revenge which the Jews always take where they can for wrongs real or imaginary. Jewish capitalism knows exactly what it is doing. What are its gains? Well, number one, it has taken a whole rich country without the cost of war. Number two, it has demonstrated the necessity of gold. Jewish power rests on the fiction that gold is wealth. By the premeditated clumsiness of the Bolshevik monetary system, the unthinking world has been made to believe still more strongly that gold is necessary, and this belief gives Jewish capitalism another hold on the Gentile world. If the Bolshevists had been honest, they could have dealt Jewish capitalism its death blow. But no. Gold is still on the throne. Destroy the fiction that gold has value, and you leave the Jewish international financiers sitting forlorn on heaps of useless metal. Well, that's something good to remember for the future. Number three, it has demonstrated its power to the world. Protocol number 7 says, to demonstrate our enslavement of the Gentile governments of Europe, we will show our power to be one of them by crimes of violence, that is, a reign of terror. Has Europe been sufficiently shown? Europe has, and it's afraid. That is a great gain for Jewish capitalists. Number 4. Not the least of the gains is the field practice in the art of revolution which Russia has offered. students of that Red School are coming back to the United States. The technique of revolution has been reduced to a science according to the details laid down in the protocols. To use Rabbi Magnus's words, again, quote, "See what a large company of Jews was available for immediate service. The available company is now much larger." That's the end of our first part of this particular installment, part 12. This was published in the Dearborn Independent, October 2nd, 1920. So that was a pretty good article. I mean, you had had a couple quotes, a couple excerpts of Jews admitting that Jews ran the Bolshevik Revolution, and this supposed paradox about why Jewish capitalists support Bolshevism, because it's Jewish. You remember the excerpt that we read that race is stronger in Jewry than is religion. Well, they'll always circle the wagons and help themselves. And the Tsar stepped on Rothschild's foot in the 19th century, and they've never forgotten about it. They never forgot that they were in ghettos in the Pale of Settlement in Russia, the steppes of Russia. They were kept in ghettos, and when they're kept down, they become a revolutionary class to overthrow the Gentile government. And it really doesn't matter what system you have, whether it's socialist or capitalist, in any Gentile country. They'll use whatever way they can to overthrow it and get Jews in control there. So there you have it. It's a pretty good article, is it not? It's interesting to note that if you can destroy the fiction that gold has value, you leave the Jewish international financiers sitting forlorn on heaps of useless metal. It goes into quite deep detail about how the Jews will use the power of gold to control countries and control economies in the protocols. Okay, I don't want to spend too much time getting into commentary because it's pretty straightforward, so let's move on to part 2 of section 12. This next section is entitled, How Jews in the U.S. Conceal Their Strength. And at the top of the page, we have an excerpt from Leo N. Levi, president of the B'nai B'rith from 1900 to 1904. Here's the quote. The distinctive character of the Jew does not arise solely from his religion. It is true that his race and religion are indissolubly connected, but whatever be the cause of this junction of the race idea with the religion, it is very certain that the religion alone does not constitute the people. A believer in the Jewish faith does not by reason of that fact become a Jew. On the other hand, however, a Jew by birth remains a Jew, even though he abjures his religion. Well, there you have it, folks. The Jewish question. Are they a race? Are they a religion? There's a lot of quotes from Jews pointing out that they're not just a religion, folks. There is a racial quality there. Take it up with them. Argue with them. Argue with the rabbis. Argue with the powerful Jews. Okay, moving on to the main body of the article. How Jews in the U.S. conceal their strength. How many Jews are there in the United States? No Gentile really knows. The figures are exclusive property of the Jewish authorities. The government of the U.S. can provide statistics on almost every matter pertaining to the population of the country, but whenever it has attempted a systematic way to get information about the Jews who are constantly entering the country, and the number now resident here, the Jewish lobby at Washington steps in and stops it. For more than 20 years, the fight for the right of the United States government to make a complete census of the people has been going on, and for the same period, the Jewish lobby at the Capitol has been strong enough to win. The alarming increase in Jewish immigration at the present time has brought the question to public attention again. For the first time in the history of the United States, a national conviction is forming upon this subject. From Europe came the first news which startled this country. The reports told of vast mobilizations of Jewish people at stated rendezvous in Europe. Great barracks were built for them. Large bodies of trained men went from the United States under orders of Jewish secret societies here to expedite passport work, as it's termed among those bodies. immigration into the U.S. became a business, a strictly Jewish business. Why is that statement made, a strictly Jewish business? Well, for this reason. There are countries in Europe from which today no Gentile can be admitted to the United States. From Germany, from Russia, from Poland, it is with the utmost difficulty that even one person can be won permission to enter this country. But Jews from Poland, Germany, and Russia, by the thousands, come in most freely, in utter disregard of the laws, in open contempt of the health regulations, a strictly Jewish business of getting another million Jews into the United States. It's like moving an army, which, having done duty in Europe for the subjugation of that continent, is now being transferred to America. When the conditions overseas were made known in this country and it became apparent that Jewish societies in the U.S. were the principal aids in this stampede to America, the newspapers, for the first time in American history, began to comment on a Jewish question in tones of alarm. This, in itself, is an indication that the facts are becoming too challenging to be longer ignored. Even the ordinary immigration officials, who for years have watched the human stream as it flowed over Ellis Island, have this year been startled into attention and action by the sharp change that has come in the character of the stream. And what has startled them? First, it's composed almost entirely of Jews. Real Ukrainians, real Russians, real Germans cannot come in. But Jews can come from anywhere, and are coming from almost everywhere. Why this special privilege? That's the question being asked. Second, they do not come as refugees, as people fleeing from hunger or persecution. They come as if they own the country. They arrive as special guests. As on the other side, the passport business is arranged, so on this side, the entrance business is arranged. The laws are set aside. Health regulations are ignored. Why should they not behave as if they own the United States? They see officials of Jewish secret societies override officials of the United States Immigration Bureau. Their first glimpse of life here shows a Jewish control as potent and complete as it is in Russia. No wonder, then, that they literally beat down the walls and gates with a cry of victorious invasion. Is this not America? The Jews' country, as it is called in the smaller nations of Europe? Third, there's a perfect organization which overcomes the numerous objections which rise against the admission of known revolutionary Jews. European Jews are potential revolutionists. They are the revolutionists of Italy, Germany, Russia, and Poland today. They are the red and international workers of the world leaders of the United States today. When one man whose record is known presents himself at Ellis Island, and of course he is one in a thousand whose records are not known, he is held up. Immediately, there start across the country telegrams to congressmen, editors, state, municipal officials, telling them in peremptory tones to get busy in behalf of Mr. So-and-so who is detained at Ellis Island. And the same day, there start back to Washington telegrams from congressmen, editors, and others of influence, insisting on the spotless character of Mr. So-and-so and demanding his immediate admittance into the U.S. Sometimes, also, the Russian embassy, so-called, is used in this work. It is an invasion, nothing but an invasion, and it is helped by influences within the United States. It is thinly cloaked with sentiment that these people are fleeing from persecution. It's cleverly assisted by photographs showing groups of forlorn-looking women and children, never photographs showing the groups of husky young revolutionists who are just as ready to despoil the United States as they were to despoil Russia. That, however, is the present situation. What this and a subsequent article propose to do for the reader is to put him in possession of some of the facts concerning the government's fight on this question during the last quarter century. The question is not peculiar to America, and it may throw a sidelight on the American phase to note some of the facts developed at the hearings of the British Royal Commission on Alien Immigration, which sat in London in 1902, a feature of whose proceedings was the testimony of Theodore Herzl, the great propagandist of Zionism. In his initial statement to the commission, Herzl made these statements, among others. The fact that there is now, for the first time since Cromwell, a perceptible number of our people in England is the true cause of this commission being called together. That a serious pressure exists in England, the fact of your commission sitting is full proof. Then the examination proceeded until the following was brought out. There's a question and answer, and the answers are Theodor Herzl's. Question. Looking at the question of alien immigration from the standpoint of the United States for a moment, you have referred to the fact that America excludes. Answer. Yes. Question. The exclusion is a partial exclusion? Answer. Exclusion, as I know, is worked in this way. The immigrant must show a certain amount of money at the moment of his landing. Question. You are aware that the stream of immigration into the U.S. is twice as much as the immigration into the United Kingdom? Answer. I know that. New York has now the greatest population of all towns in the world. Question. And the actual exclusion is the actual exclusion of a small proportion? Answer. Yes, but they go, however, to America. I think it is so easy to evade such a prohibition. For instance, if they joined a small company, it would lend the necessary amount to each immigrant, and the immigrant shows it and comes in, and sends back by post the amount he has borrowed. There are no efficacious measures to prevent that. Question. I took it that your reference to the U.S. was an approval of the action of that country as an act of self-preservation. Answer. No. A little later on in the examination, the question of immigration to the United States was again brought in. The answers are still Dr. Herzl's. Remember that the date is still 1902 here. Question. Are you aware whether it is the fact or not that the leading Jews in America have informed their correspondents here that they cannot receive and distribute any more Jewish immigrants? Answer. I have heard of difficulties of emigration, and that they are overcrowded with Jews. As to that information, I cannot say. Question. In your opinion, would not the stream of emigration to America have been much greater if no such law had existed? Answer. I think this law did not alter it much. The prohibition could not change it. Question. On what grounds do you believe that? Answer. It is a question of coasts and harbors. They come in. How will you prevent a man from coming in? Question. Do you mean they're smuggled in? Answer. No, I don't believe that, but they always find a means to come in. Now, back to the text here. Now, discussion of immigration in the United States has never been free. We have talked a great deal about it in general terms, but not in terms of specific races, except the Chinese and Japanese. However, Herzl seems to have known that wherever the Jews congregate in noticeable numbers, they become a trouble. His exact words are, America, where so soon as they form a perceptible number, they become a trouble and a burden to the land. And he also knew that efforts would be made to meet that condition. But more than that, he dropped what must be construed as a warning that such efforts would be resisted. He said this, quote, there exists a French proverb, cet animal est très impatient, elle se défend quand on l'attaque. If the Jews are attacked, they will defend themselves, and you will get something like internal troubles. My French is terrible, please forgive me. The time apparently did come in the U.S. when some far-seeing official began to wonder what the Jewish invasion portended. Already, it was too strong to be openly attacked. The Jewish lobby at Washington was powerful even in that time. So, apparently, this official concluded that the best way to set about so momentous a task was to collect the information. But in order to get the information, Congress had to give its permission. And to get the permission of Congress, hearings had to be ordered. Hearings were ordered, and the records of them, though very scarce, still exist. The reader will be given important extracts from them presently, and he will see for himself how certain American statesmen reacted to the whole matter. A remark is in order just here, namely, that the Jewish lobby eventually became more skillful in such matters. It now takes very good care that no officials shall be appointed who shall make suggestions which shall precipitate congressional hearings on the Jewish matter. The time is coming, of course, when the whole Jewish question may be threshed out by the government of the U.S., but it will not be because an official precipitated it. It will be because the people will demand it. Officials are now much too wary to meddle with this question. They know too well the consequences. During the war, many a secret trail of danger led into Jewish quarters, and the Secret Service man who loyally made his reports was often surprised to find himself lifted completely off that trail. Why? All Jewish trails in this country were powerfully protected by hidden influences during the war. Well, the time came in the United States when it was obviously desirable to know what elements were comprising our population, whether we were an Anglo-Saxon nation, Semitic, Latin, or whatever. The situation was this, and was so stated by the government officials at the time. In the 80s, and previously, it could be safely assumed that an immigrant from Ireland was Irish, an immigrant from Norway or Sweden was Scandinavian, and an immigrant from Russia was Russian, and an immigrant from Germany was German, and so on. But times changed. Previous to 1880, the entry on a man's record, born in Russia, indicated that he was a Russian. But, says a statement made by a government official with reference to the 10 years following 1880, so many Hebrews have come that the country, from that country to the United States, that born in Russia has become in popular opinion to mean a Russian Jew. And then the same official goes on to show that during a 10-year period when 666,561 Jews came from Russia, there came also from Russia a large number of Poles, Finns, Germans, and Lithuanians. Now, to make a census enumeration of these peoples under the heading Russian was plainly misleading, and not only misleading, but valueless for census purposes. The racial identity would be lost, and our knowledge of the racial makeup of the nation very incomplete. Therefore, the census authorities asked Congress for permission to classify people by race as well as by country of birth. It seemed perfectly reasonable. Of what possible use is it to classify 3 million Jews as Russians when there are very few real Russians in the country and when the Russian and the Jew are so deeply different from one another? Senator Simon Guggenheim arose in the committee to object. He used the common formula in such cases. He said this, "Personally, I object to it, not because I am a Hebrew, but because it is not in place." That's the common Jewish formula of objection. The B'nai B'rith says the same thing when it forces Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice out of the public schools. That society's Anti-Defamation Circular always includes the thought, "We do not base our request on the embarrassment which may be caused to the Jewish students in class, nor is our attitude in this regard based on thin-skinned sensitiveness. Our objection is made because of the effect upon the non-Jewish children who subconsciously will associate in their minds the Jew as Shakespeare portrayed him with the Jew of today." So Senator Guggenheim, therefore, was playing the game according to the rules made and established in such cases. At this hearing, Senator La Follette was a chairman. Senator Guggenheim's contention was that Jew was the name of a member of a religious denomination, and not of a race. Chairman La Follette said, "I can see broad ethnological reasons why some time it would be important to know from what blood and race the man came." Senator Guggenheim responds, "Well, why not ask his religion?" Senators McCumber and Bailey came to the support of Senator Guggenheim's contention that Jew is a religious and not a racial term. Chairman La Follette responds, "I do not just get your objection to this, Senator Guggenheim. What objection can one have to having the race to which he belongs correctly entered?" Senator Guggenheim says, "Because it's not correct when stated that way. The Jews are not a race." Later on in the hearing, Senator Cummins entered the discussion in response to a pro-Jewish remark made by Senator Bailey. Senator Bailey said, "If I were a Hebrew and I had been born here and they wanted me to say I was anything but an American, I would have a difference with the enumerator. I perhaps would refuse to answer their questions." Senator Cummins says, "I would not have any hesitancy in stating from what blood I was." Senator Bailey responds, "No, but in the case that I referred to, it would be a matter of religion." Senator Guggenheim jumps in, "That's the point. It's a question of religion." That took place in April 1909. In December 1909, Simon Wolf was the chief witness for the pro-Jewish contention. Simon Wolf is a very interesting character. From before the days of President Lincoln, he has been a lobbyist for the Jews at the National Capitol, and has been in contact with every president from Lincoln to Wilson. At the hearing where Mr. Wolf testified, Senator Dillingham acted as chairman, and the whole proceeding was enlivened and clarified by the vigorous part which Senator Lodge took in it. Certain extracts, which entirely reproduce the spirit and argument of the hearing, follow here. Mr. Wolf: "The point we make is this. A Jew coming from Russia is a Russian, from Romania a Romanian, from France a Frenchman, from England an Englishman, and from Germany a German. That Hebrew or Jewish is simply a religion." Senator Lodge: "Do I understand you to deny that the Jews are a race?" Mr. Wolf: "How?" Senator Lodge: "Do you deny that the word Jew is used to express a race?" Mr. Wolf: "As a representative of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, which I have been for nearly 30 years, I took up the matter and propounded a series of interrogations to some of the leading Jews of the United States, among others. Dr. Cyrus Adler, who is librarian of the Smithsonian, and every one of them states that the Jews are not a race." Senator Lodge: "That, I think, is an important point. I have always supposed they were. I find in the preface of the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is signed by Cyrus Adler, among others, this statement: 'An even more delicate problem that presented itself at the very outset was the attitude to be observed by the Encyclopedia in regard to those Jews who, while born within the Jewish community, have, for one reason or another, abandoned it. As the present work deals with the Jews as a race, it was found impossible to exclude those who were of that race, whatever their religious affiliations might have been.' In the same encyclopedia is a statement by Joseph Jacobs, formerly president of the Jewish Historical Society of England. And it says, 'Anthropologically considered, the Jews are a race of markedly uniform type, due either to unity of race or to similarity of environment.' Do you mean to deny, I want to understand your position, that the word Jew is a racial term?" Mr. Wolf: "I have made my statement, and my opinions are in this pamphlet." Senator Lodge: "Let me get at it. How would you classify Benjamin Disraeli? Was he a Jew?" Mr. Wolf: "He was born a Jew." Senator Lodge says, "He was baptized as a Christian. He then ceased to be a Jew?" Mr. Wolf: "Yes, religiously he ceased to be a Jew." Senator Lodge: "Ah, religiously. He was very proud of the fact that he was a Jew and always spoke of himself in that way. Did the fact that he changed his religion alter his race?" Mr. Wolf: "It did not change the fact that he was born a Jew, not at all. And I know the Jewish people throughout the world have claimed him, Hein, Born, and others who were born of their blood as being Jews, when they speak of persons who have accomplished something wonderful in the world, but they cease to be Jews from the standpoint of religion." Senator Lodge: "Undoubtedly. What I want to get at is whether the word Jew or Hebrew is a correct racial term." Mr. Wolf: "If you will pardon me, you will find a letter from Dr. Cyrus Adler right at the close of the pamphlet, which perhaps you might read for the benefit of the committee." Senator Lodge, after reading the letter he referred to: "I do not think that answers anything." Senator Lodge goes on to state, It never occurred to me until I heard you were coming here that the classification as made by the immigration authorities had anything to do with religion. I supposed it was a race classification. It is important, very important, to get the race classification as nearly as we can. Mr. Wolf says, you are aware that the Census Bureau some time ago attempted to classify in the same manner, and it was prohibited from doing so. Senator Lodge, the word race was stricken out of the census bill. I think it was a great mistake. It makes the returns almost valueless. Mr. Wolf says, I can simply repeat what I have said, that I am voicing the opinions of those whom I represent, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations and the Order of B'nai B'rith. They are opposed to the classification as made in the last few years, and as contemplated, so far as I am informed, in the report of the commission. The hearings continued, Julian W. Mack later appearing for the Jewish contention. From the extracts given in this article, four matters become very clear. First, the Jew is opposed to any restrictive legislation against his entry into a country. Second, the Jew is opposed to any racial classification of himself after he's entered a country. Third, the Jewish argument to the Gentile authorities is that the Jew represents a religion and not a race. Fourth, that at least one indication has appeared in which the Jew has one view to present to the Gentiles and another which he cherishes among his own people on the question of race. Another point might be made is this. When the authorities disregard as untenable the argument of religion, not race, the Jewish spokesmen fall back on the fact that their organizations don't want certain things and won't have certain things. Argument or no argument, commission or no commission. The Jewish lobbyists had their way. There is no enumeration of Jews in the United States. There are 46 other classifications, but none for the Jew. The Northern Italians are distinguished in the records from the Southern Italians. The Moravians are distinguished from the Bohemians, the Scotch from the English, the Spanish Americans from the Spanish Europeans, the West Indians from the Mexicans, but the Jew is not distinguished at all. None of the other races made objection. On this point, the report of the commission reads like this. As far as ascertained by the commission, the practice of classifying the foreign-born by race or people, rather than by country of birth, is acceptable to the people of the United States with one exception. The officials, who were endeavoring to have the census report show with scientific accuracy the actual racial components of the population of the United States, were compelled to see their recommendation eliminated. What's the result? If you ask the government of the U.S. how many Frenchmen there are in the country, it can give you the figures. If you ask for the number of Poles, it's there also. If you ask for the number of Africans, that too is known. On down a long list, you may make your inquiries, and you will find that the government knows. But ask the government of the United States how many Jews are in the country, and it cannot tell you, because there are no records. If you want information upon that point, you will have to go to the officials or the representatives of the Jewish government in the United States. Of course, if Jew is a religious term, like Baptist, Catholic, Christian Scientist, or Quaker, then there is merit in the argument that religious questions are not proper for the government to ask unless the religion comes in conflict with, or is a menace to, the ideals of the Republic. But if Jew is a racial term, or a national term, then the government is properly interested in making record of all the inhabitants of this land who bear it. Like all questions pertaining to the Jews, this can be settled by their own words. What the Jews teach the Jews on this matter should be the determining point. In the next article, we shall see what Jews themselves have to say about the old-time question, race or religion, which I guess you can more accurately say is the Jewish question. This was published on October 9th, 1920. Not a whole lot of commentary on this one. It's pretty much straightforward, is it not? The Jews, among themselves, consider themselves a race, not just a religion, but to the Gentiles, they call themselves a religion. Pretty obvious. Until next time, guys, this is Ted Midward of Caucasian Christian Communications signing off. Take care, God bless, bye-bye.